history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown is, perhaps, as we're going to hear today, you don't really even have a hometown, so to speak. No matter where you are, there are some stories out there that the rest of us need to hear. We'll never hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions, to listen what comes back our way. And the idea is to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made, to preserve their stories so we never forget that price has been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, boy, how much we learn. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I'm pretty sure that's going to be the case today with 94-year-old Chuck Ferriter of Claremont, California. Pretty amazing that this guy is alive. And I guess, Chuck, I can call you a walking miracle because it seems like a miracle that you're walking.
That's the truth.
And we're going to get to why that's the case. But
I won't deny it.
Take me back to Custer County, Nebraska, as a boy. How'd your family end up in those parts?
Well, they were Irish immigrants, and they landed in Boston, and trying to find food, they started west, and the obviously available employment was to work in coal mines. But they were Irishmen. They didn't like the idea of being down in a hole. They were used to fishing and farming on those beautiful hills in Ireland. But you got to eat, so they went into the coal mines. And my great-grandpa got his mind settled to him being in there, but didn't want to let his kids get in there. So he kept going west, looking for some way to make a living without getting in your hands dirty in coal dust. His movement west coincided with when the Sioux Indians tried to kill off the Pawnee. They damn near did it. They, instead of going hunting for winter food, they went hunting for Pawnee, and they killed 80% of them. People don't even know that happened, but it did. And the government decided they'll do it again if we don't get these people out of here. So they moved the Pawnee to, it had already been created, the Indian Territory in Oklahoma. They took the Pawnee to Oklahoma, and pony soldiers chased the Sioux back up north.
So that opened up that land for homesteading?
Exactly. Grandpa saw a brochure and free land in the sand hills of Nebraska. Didn't have a clue what a sandhill looked like, or he was just an Irish fisherman. But he kept moving and finally filed a claim. There was a limit depending on the productivity of the soil. I don't know who made the judgments, but cattle country, you got more land than in land that was rich with black soil. So he ended up with a section, which is 740 acres, I think, which is a good piece of land. They put all of their stuff and all the kids in a railroad car and headed west, and that train dropped their car. They had a whole car. When they got to Wood River, Nebraska, the conductor, they didn't announce it at all. They just stopped and started unhooking the car. And the family didn't know where they were at all. The village they were in was called Wood River, which they had no clue. But eventually they got used to being temporary residents of Wood River, and the railroad unhooked the car and put it on a siding, and it was up to them to get their stuff off of it. They had taken a Studebaker wagon apart, and it was part of their cargo. So they had to figure out how to put that wagon back together. It had come disassembled, but they managed to get it together, and then they put everything in it and went shopping for a team of horses. The guy that they were talking to about the horses, he was a knowledgeable old guy. It was a business that he had set up. He met people at the train, and he helped them buy their horses. And he suggested that they use a three-hitch team. They managed to get out of town without running over anything. And once they got out on the trail, and it was all it was a trail. There were no roads anywhere. The old guy that they were talking to, this gun up here is his gun.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know whether it was his or his wife's. They both had one. It's a muzzle-loading rifle. They didn't end up with a three-horse hitch. They had two teams. He felt he'd do better with two. He was familiar with horses because he'd worked with them in the mines. I guess horses go down in those mines and never come out.
That's right.
They're down there their whole life. He suggested that they buy enough lumber to shore a well, 20-foot deep well, so they had that material there. And they said you better buy a window, at least one window and a door for the house you got to build. And they did that, and all this stuff is going into the Studebaker wagon. The guy that they bought the horses from gave Grandma a female dog. He said, you're going to need somebody to talk to, and this little lady will talk to you if you just listen good. And it turned out to be the case.
And you have a photograph here from 1888 that shows your ancestors on that plot of land. And there's some beautiful-looking horses in that photo. And is it true that they had to catch all those wild horses?
Yeah, one of my aunts, Aunt Jenny, learned how to catch them from Indian folks that came by. The Pawnee that had been moved to Oklahoma, they walked home again, just little pods of them. And they always were hiding from the pony soldiers because they'd walk them back if they caught them.
And you heard all these stories growing up from your grandparents or what?
Yeah.
The land we're talking about that your family had homesteaded in the 1800s is where you were born, out
yeah.
on the ranch.
Yeah, I was born right there. Originally, when they got there, being instructed by the old guy that took them there, he called himself a land locator. And that's exactly what he was, land that was available for homesteading. Just their getting out of town without an accident was a miracle. They traveled that whole day toward the northwest. At sundown, all of the kids and a calf, they bought a cow. And of course, she came with a calf because they wanted her for milk. The calf and all the kids were up on top of this lumber and all the other stuff they had loaded into the wagon. When they managed to get down off of it, Grandpa had to help them. Getting down was no small thing. They were delighted to play in the meadow that they were in. They just thought, this is the greatest. And they spent the night under the wagon, sleeping. And then next day, on to bigger and greater things toward the northwest. And eventually, they got to their valley. They pulled their team, pulled this wagon up over a crest of a hill, and the old land locator said, this is it, pointed out toward a nice flat valley. And he says, this is home. And just by happenstance, there was a doe and her fawn not 25 feet away. She didn't know who they were or what they were, but she didn't scare them until one of the horses shook his head to chase the nosefly, and that scared the doe, and she ran. But they always felt that the doe didn't go away. She was their neighbor.
And what I'm interested in hearing from you, I mean, I can imagine some of the things you might have done, but growing up in that area of the country, on that ranch, in the 20s and 30s, as one of six kids in your family with three boys and three girls, what were those years like for you?
Interesting. Really so. And World War I came along. I was born in 24.
Right after World War I?
Yeah. But a lot of guys came home badly hurt and dying as they walked. I remember all of that. We were just told to never mind. They'll probably die. And of course they did. I remember one old cowboy, and they all had to work. No free lunch. If they didn't work, they didn't eat. I remember there was one old guy, a cowboy named Mr. Lewis, and I used to try to sidle my pony over alongside him so I could talk to him, but he wouldn't talk. He'd cough. Of course, their lungs were gone. That gas in World War
I. Oh, sure, yeah.
He'd cough and spit downwind and then touch a spur to his pony and get away from the question. And I never got a chance to talk to him, never learned his story.
Well, and you shared something there. You said sidled up next to him on your pony.
Yeah.
I bet you did a lot of things on all that acreage as a kid. What were some of the things you look back on and say, that was really exciting or that was really tough?
It was all tough and it was all exciting. No, it really was.
What kind of chores did you have to do?
For instance, I remember one particular day, my dad had told me, this was when I was in school, I was probably in second grade or something. He wanted me to go out to the hills on the south side where they had caught the horses in the old days. They called it the early days. They had dug a well out there and a windmill so that there was water there for their stock. My dad told me to go make sure that the well was pumping water. As long as it did, just leave it alone. Going back to the schoolhouse, and the school was something I should talk about. My dad and his brothers and his father built the school. It was a little square white building. It was probably 20 by 30. And that's where everybody went to school. All the kids off of all the ranches all around, they all came there and went to school. It was District 222.
And I'm just guessing that everybody from the youngsters to the high schoolers are all in that same building together?
Oh, yeah. There were benches and there were different classes, and the class was held over in the corner. When your class wasn't in order, you were in your bench or chair working. So it just, everybody worked all the time.
Well, I know your family had six kids in the school, but how many children total in this country school?
Every year was different. By the time I got to high school, there were 34 people in my class.
That's a pretty big class.
But out in that country school, District 222, I doubt if there were ever 20 kids altogether.
So you grow up, you've got an older brother, a younger brother, you've got three sisters. When you're out there on all that wide open space, what are those dreams that are floating through your head that you're saying, hey, someday when I'm bigger, when I'm grown up, I'm going to do this and this and this and this?
Very little of that.
Yeah? Didn't have time?
Didn't have time. Dealing with what every day. I don't recall sitting around dreaming at all. No, we were just too busy.
And when your brother, your older brother John, decided to join the Marine Corps in 1938, was that a big deal?
It was a big deal. And he had no idea what he was getting into. It so happened that the boys all slept in a room upstairs in the house that they built, replacing the dugout and those shelters. There were three of us, three brothers. You'd get wakened once in a while, people pounding on you. I remember my little brother one time says, Chuck, you ate too many watermelons. You peed the bed. My mom was so organized, a little Irish girl who went out west and married a cowboy. She had a plan for everything. She said, when that happens, you guys get up. Don't make a sound. Don't want to you waking anybody else up. Dry linen is on the shelf right there. You know where it is. Change everything that's wet and throw that in the pile in the corner. Then go back to bed and don't say nothing to anybody. So she had it all worked out.
How'd you get along with those two brothers?
Pretty good. What put me to that thought, my older brother entertained us every night, told us a story. And it was an ongoing, never-ending story about his experiences in the Army. He didn't know about the Marine Corps at that time, so he was in the Army.
In his imagination, he was in the Army.
All just imagination.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, he read it in dime novels.
Sure.
That's where he got his ideas. I remember my younger brother, we're playing out in the yard, and he said, I don't know how we're going to get out of that problem with Sergeant, whatever his name, Sergeant Brown. And I, for a minute, didn't know who the hell Sergeant Brown was. But but then I remembered, oh, he was in the story last night. This little guy was worried about it. He thought it was real.
The stories must have been pretty real to him.
Yeah.
Well, and then in a few years, the stories would be real.
Yeah.
Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Yeah, sure do. It was a beautiful sunny day. We didn't know where Pearl Harbor was, but we did know where Hawaii was. There was a globe in our school, and all of us studied that globe. That morning, my dad had gotten up early, and he was doing his chores. And when he came in, he said, the damn Japs have bombed Pearl Harbor. And all of us said, where's Pearl Harbor? Thought it might be over the next hill. He said, no, it's on Hawaii. Of course, then we knew where Hawaii was. And that was about the end of it, really. By that time, my brother had already joined the Marine Corps, so we wondered if he was okay. And it turned out that he was on liberty in L.A. when it happened. And people in their cars, picked the servicemen up and took them to their base.
And your brother ended up serving throughout World War II and even the Korean War in the Marines?
Yeah.
And when did Chuck decide, you know, I'm going to have to be part of this worldwide conflict myself?
Well, it came kind of in stages. In high school, I took a test that was for what they called the Navy V-12 program. I think that was the name of it.
Yeah, you go to college instead of going overseas.
For 2 years. Uh-huh. You go to college 2 years, and they teach you to fly an airplane. And anyway, I passed the test and So I had that in my back pocket, kind of waiting for the draft board to make it necessary to go, because everything depended on that. The folks wouldn't let me go until I was being drafted. I mean, they needed everybody.
Yeah, they've got a lot of land, a lot of animals, a lot of stuff to take care of.
Yeah, but the letters from the draft board began to get very serious, so I went to Omaha to join the Navy V-12 program. Got down there, and it turned out that by that time, the program was still there, but they didn't really take it serious anymore. They already had all their pilots that they needed, so they found that I had a heart murmur. I didn't know what the hell that was, so it didn't bother me at all, but I knew I was in and out of the program before I knew what happened. Going back to the bus station to get a bus home, when I walked into the station, there was a sign there, taller than I was, that said, "Join the Merchant Marine," and there was a phone number. And I thought, I wonder what it'll cost to call. But it must have been a toll-free number because the guy answered right away. And the guy that answered said, "Where are you?" I guess the calls came from everywhere.
Sure.
I said, "I'm in Omaha, Nebraska." He says, "Are you a cowboy?" And I didn't know whether to say yes or no. I didn't know whether it'd be good or bad. But I took a chance, and I said, "Yeah, I'm a cowboy." He said, "Good. Cowboys make good sailors. They learn to take care of their horse, and that helps them to understand they got to take care of their ship."
Huh.
I said, I'm down here to join the Navy V-12 program, and they told me I got a heart murmur. He says, "Oh, pay no attention to that. Those guys have never been to sea. They don't know what the hell's going on." Because they hadn't been to sea, they didn't know nothing in his mind.
Right.
Anyway, he said, "You got to either go to Catalina Island in California or Sheepshead Bay in New York." And he said, "I think Sheepshead Bay is easiest for you." So I got on a train. How I had enough money, I don't know, really. But they had given me money because they didn't really know what was going to happen when I left. But the ticket was only like $6 or something. But that, in those days, was still a lot of money. And the trains were absolutely packed. And I sat on a cream can. I don't know whose cream can it was, but that first night I sat on this cream can in the vestibule. I couldn't even get in the train. When I eventually got inside and actually had a chair, I was somewhere in Illinois or someplace by then. And eventually I crossed the Hudson River, and the guy on the phone had told me, he said, "Just get off the train at Penn Station. Any cab driver will bring you out to where we are, Sheepshead Bay." So that's what happened. I got in a cab, and he took me right to Sheepshead Bay, and they immediately started making a sailor out of a cowboy.
How was that transition for you?
It was easy. I loved the whole thing.
And what kind of ship did they put you on?
Well, getting on a ship was something else. Actually, you know, at that time, those ships leaving New York were being sunk before they got out of sight.
All the U-boats in the Atlantic?
Yeah. But they put me back on a train to go to the Aleutian Islands. And I got on a ship at Seattle and went to Dutch Harbor. And at Dutch Harbor, I got on the ship I was assigned to, which is, they call it an FS freighter, just small freighter, and went on out to Attu and Kiska out in the Aleutians. I was out there for all winter. There's two ratings, ordinary seaman and able seaman. When you go aboard, you're ordinary, and then you get to be able. What the ship did was take toilet paper and ammunition and everything that all of the troops needed.
Mm-hmm.
We took them from Dutch Harbor out to where they were needed. Then that was over when the Japanese bugged out one day. They were living above the cloud line. That the Aleutian Islands is just a god-awful place. They're little green hills that poke their top of them up into the cloud fog. And the Japanese got in there and got up above the clouds, and they were shooting down at the GIs down, terrible casualties, and they were scot-free up there. You couldn't see them. But one day they left. That changed everything, and we left.
No troops that needed to be supplied anymore, no, so you guys went elsewhere. So where'd you go from there?
To the big ships. Went back to Seattle and got on a hospital ship. But I liked the bigger ships once I got onto them.
It's time for our first break, but there is much more to come from Chuck Ferreter of Claremont, California. He served in the Merchant Marines during World War II and the Korean War when he ended up suffering a catastrophic injury. If you'd like to order his book, The Dog Star Had Their Back, it's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back. right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Chuck Ferreter of Claremont, California, our guest today. And I want to thank a longtime listener for connecting us to his friend Chuck. Drew Miller listened to Hometown Heroes for years on our affiliate in Salem, Oregon, KYKN, before he moved down to Southern California, where he got to know this nonagenarian with a story that is really remarkable. Just to give you a taste of what's to come with this Merchant Marine veteran, let me read this brief excerpt from his book about a tragic run-in with a dog-leg crane during the Korean War. The load in this new pick was swinging dangerously wide and would hit crew members on the deck. When Chuck heard the "look out" shouts, he turned to see the load only a couple of arm's lengths away and was coming on quickly. He made the decision that both he and Frank had to jump over the ship's railing to escape. He shouted to Frank, "Frank, we've got to go over the side. We should land safely in the water." Chuck jumped immediately. He found himself lying on his side in the air in the temporary safety of the space beyond the bulwark of the ship. He couldn't see him, but he hoped that Frank was there with him. Again, that's from his book, The Dog Star Had Their Back. And you're going to hear Chuck describe that incident in his own words before we're done today.
Well, by then I had developed some skills and I was qualified as an able seaman. And then the picture that's in the, I'm a quartermaster by then, and then a chief quartermaster. The chief quartermaster is a good job. You're responsible for the whole bridge, all the equipment, maintain it and fix whatever's wrong or replace it.
And where did that hospital ship go?
Literally everywhere. We always went to a place to get the doctors. They went usually one trip at a time. We'd pick them up, doctors and nurses, and the equipment that they needed. It all had to be fresh. We'd take them to whatever the thing they were going to and bring them home again and take new ones to someplace else. I remember we left Seattle. The French were fighting a war in Vietnam and developing a lot of casualties. And somebody in Washington decided that we needed to send a ship down there to stand off shore and take those casualties home to France. So we loaded up with new doctors and new men and new supplies and headed that way. And we got about as far as the New Hebrides, and they canceled it. So we never went. And by then, it was getting well along, and I guess somebody just decided that we didn't need to get involved with that crazy thing down there, but eventually did. By then, World War II was over. Duty didn't change at all. We were still doing the same thing, dashing here and dashing there with supplies. And then when Korea came along, that changed things again, but only slightly. We were sent back to California to get the 1st Marine Division from Camp Pendleton. And we took them to that port at the south end of the peninsula, was called Pusan. As soon as the Marines got there, these North Koreans knew that the fun was over. They thought, what's going on here? These guys aren't afraid of us. After just a couple of weeks, they had leveled that thing out, the Marine Corps. And they got back on Navy transports and went to Incheon and landed, and the North Koreans, they didn't want to get cut off, so they couldn't get home. So they ran home. They literally ran home. And the war was over, technically, because the UN orders were to dispel the North Korean troops from South Korea. But Doug, General MacArthur, it was quoted in Life magazine, he wanted to poke a stick in the eye of the Chinese commies. So he sent the 8th Army, sent the 1st American Marines, 1st Division, around to the East Coast to Hang Nam, and they went on our ship. We put them ashore there, and they went up the hill and disappeared. And I guess the second day, they're in the area of the Chosin Reservoir. When they woke up in the morning, instead of the hills being white with snow, they were brown with a couple of armies of Chinese soldiers. And they fought their way out. They just turned around and fought their way back to the coast. And as soon as they got to that hill, we saw them go over. Of course, we knew what was happening by radio.
And did you guys have to stay there to prepare for casualties?
That's right. We were there to supply them. Actually, they were headed for the other edge of Korea, which was the Chinese border.
Right.
And that was MacArthur's order. Anyway, they fought their way back up to the top of that hill. And once they were over it, the Chinese didn't come because they knew we had Navy ships down there that could hit them. So they never came over the hill. So the Marines came down. We took them back to Pusan. We were loaded full with North Korean civilians, men and women and little kids. They were just fleeing to get out. And when we got there, we had three babies, brand new little babies, left the North with X number and gained three on the way south. But the Marines then went back into line, and they were fighting Chinese. And that went on until it was over 3 years later.
And you're witnessing this from the deck of your ship?
Yep.
So you're watching the lines move, and you're watching guys die.
We were always on the move, but we knew what was going on. You know, it's a big country, so we weren't seeing their battles with the Chinese. It's just out of sight. You know, when the Marines, when they come over that mountain, they had all of their dead and all of their casualties with them. They didn't leave a soul. That's remarkable.
Well, we're talking about the Korean War, but I don't want to leave out, you know, the chapter of World War II. You've got one brother who's in the Marines throughout. You have another brother who ends up wounded serving in the Army in Okinawa. And then you've got your own experience. Have you ever thought about what it must have been like for your mother to have three boys overseas in this war?
Yeah, she had a flag in the window with three stars on it.
And what happened to your younger brother?
He was in, I think he called it the 9th Army in Okinawa. And they were advancing into trenches that the Japanese had been in. And one morning, quarters were close. My brother saw a white phosphorus grenade, which I don't know whether the Japanese had them or not, but it was pretty much an American thing. And it was white phosphorus. It just burnt everything. If you put it on a desk, it'd burn a hole right through the desk. And he saw this thing land in front of him, thrown by some yahoo in the back of him.
One of his own guys.
Yeah, and didn't throw it far enough, and here it was. So he reached down to try to pick it up and throw it farther, and it exploded. They had to replace his eyelids and his nose, pieces of his cheeks and his hands. His buddy got him to an aid station, couldn't get his rifle out of his hands. It was welded into his hands. But eventually the medics got the rifle out of his hand. I think he went aboard the Navy hospital ship Comfort. Some general came aboard, and of course he was all in big white bandages and was knocked out because of the pain. So he didn't see anything, but they left his ribbons and his Purple Heart and all that stuff on a pillow on his bed.
Well, and you must have been still on your ship when you caught word of what had happened to him.
That's right. And my older brother was still there, too. I actually found out about it from home. Ed had been sent to Beaumont General Hospital in Texas, and my sister went down there to see him, and she told us about him. I'm sure Mom got a telegram or something, but no details. But we got the details from our sister. Poor kid was there for months with these endless operations. It takes a while to build an eyelid. I guess they build a little bit and then have to put more on it and then more. But you know that brave little kid and his hands, they were all burnt. But his clothes protected the rest of him, and his helmet protected his forehead, so he didn't have anything on his forehead, just what was exposed. Ed had a dog. By that time, our folks had sold off the cattle and were living in Broken Bow. They had retired and gone to town, literally. Mm-hmm. The old dog, ranch dogs really didn't get old. They rattlesnakes and big animals. There's too many things around to kill them, so they didn't last long. But this old dog, my mom decided to keep him alive until Eddie got home some way. And damned if she didn't. He came home from the hospital with his coat with brass buttons and rawhide boots, and the old dog was there, and he sensed that he was blind, as old dogs all are, but he sensed that Ed was there. And he got up and walked over and sniffed his knee, decided that it was Ed and that everything was okay. So he laid down across his feet like he always did.
Well, and little did you know at the time the amount of time you'd be spending in hospitals and in operations. But what about the end of World War II? Because most of the people listening right now didn't live through this. How did you process that, or how significant a development was that for here a young Merchant Marine, who's got a couple other brothers who've been fighting this war for a few years?
We were not philosophers. We didn't think a hell of a lot about it, I guess. We just dealt with each thing each day. I can't explain it any further than that. And I think we would have went nuts if we had tried to figure it all out.
Let me ask you this, Chuck. You proud of your two brothers?
Yep. I've written about them. They're just the bravest guys I know.
So you mentioned you served in the Merchant Marine during World War II and during the Korean War. And in between those two conflicts,
we were as busy as we were during the war.
Well, I believe it. And you also had a very significant development in your life come about.
Yeah.
It was very important that you end up meeting this person.
Yeah. The year must have been about 49. And I was at home. Anybody going to Nebraska, and this was in December, anybody going there takes clothes to stay warm.
Sure.
So I had the clothes I needed. But wouldn't you know, not the usual bad weather. It was called the Blizzard of 49. It killed thousands of cattle and reindeer and wild animals and hundreds of people. Anyway, I'm home there. I get on the train. It was called the City of Omaha, headed for Los Angeles. And I got on it, and it got about almost to North Platte. There are cottonwood trees all along the railroad, but they all disappeared. It was snowing so heavy that you couldn't see 2 feet ahead of you. And, of course, I got all my information in the bar. Anybody knows that.
On the train?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I went to the bar and asked the guy. I said, Pete, what the hell's going on? He said, you know, we're in a storm that nobody on this eastern slope has ever seen before. He said, there's a train up ahead of us, stopped and already frozen up. And he says, I don't know what's happening to those people on that. I couldn't worry about that. You just deal with the day that's ahead of you. There was a bar, a famous bar, across the street from the depot. They had a leather steer in there that had a saddle on him, and you got on him and you put a quarter in him, he would shake your eyebrows loose. He'd throw you across the room if you let go. So I spent several days both shooting and riding the bull. Eventually, we did get out of there, and what they did to get around that train that was stalled, they went down to Greeley, Colorado, on what they called the Beef Line. Must have been about the fourth or fifth day of the storm. This train that was up ahead of us, the village that they had stopped in, thank God they stopped in a village so that they'd have someplace to go. The people on the train, there were 250 of them. They put them all in the depot in this little town called Hillsdale, Wyoming. Now that's like a 3-bedroom house with 300 people in it. There were no medical particular supplies. Nothing had been set aside to handle an emergency like that. But there were two nurses aboard that train that were headed for Honolulu to work. Mm-hmm. They had graduated from their nursing school in New Jersey, and they were on their way. When this thing happened, suddenly the only people responsible for 200 and some people, and they took it very seriously. They had pregnant women. They had old guys with heart attacks. They just dealt with whatever came up. Eventually, the railroad people got them out of that depot and put them into a schoolhouse and a church, which made conditions a lot better. People could breathe. Eventually, they started working on getting them out of there, and they got the idea of using those beef lines, and they sent buses to Greeley. And there were doctors in the buses when they came, so it released the girls so they were free. They were able to go down to Greeley and catch their train to go.
The nurses finally got a break.
Yeah, they finally got a break. They were just so exhausted. They got to Greeley and were told, well, there's nobody here, but there's a train coming in. So that these two girls, with most of their 300 people that they had literally saved, were ready to go to California. And when I first saw them was the next morning when my train picked them up. There was a little Mormon lady. In those days, all the older people with white hair blued it, they called it. Even this little old Mormon lady had her hair blued. And I got acquainted with her. I took her to a movie in North Platte. It was a double feature, and she kept her hands over her eyes for the first one, which was a pretty brutal picture. But the next one was the musical with Hosea Turby playing the piano, and she loved it. Anyway, this little beautiful little old lady, she met these two girls, and she told them, there's a nice young man on the ship train that has a ship that's probably going to go to Hawaii, and he can probably give you a ride. This is all just dream stuff out of her head.
I was going to say, that's not usually the way those ships work.
Anyway, this pretty girl comes and sits down across the table. She says, we have a mutual friend, and he says that you have a boat that may be going to Hawaii. I said, I don't know what that person is drinking, but boats don't go to Hawaii. They go to Catalina, maybe, but it takes a ship to get to Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
This pretty girl stood up and says, well, I didn't come here to have a lecture in semantics, so I'm out of here. So I jumped up and ran after her and managed to save my butt, but it almost didn't work.
And it strikes me, Chuck, and at this time you don't know that you're going to marry this girl, that you're going to need her nursing skills and her care and her advocacy to survive what you are going to go through. But how many things had to happen? How many strings did the guy upstairs have to pull to get you two together?
Incredible. Just that so many things happen. More than coincidence. Huh? If you try to explain it all, you go crazy. So I just accept it.
And if you think the story of how Chuck and Muriel met is wild, wait till you hear what he had to survive before they could get married, and the role she played in helping him recover from physical and emotional injuries. Check out photos and video of Chuck at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the unique story of a merchant marine veteran named Chuck Ferriter. He's pretty well known in Claremont, California, where he spent more than six decades. He built quite a few homes and senior apartments there, and he has impacted countless lives. But his life was almost cut short before he ever ended up in the Golden State. We heard about how a deadly snowstorm, rerouted train cars, and a little old lady conspired to connect him with a young nurse named Muriel. Read his book, it's linked for you online, for the improbable manner in which Chuck ended up with some time to pursue Muriel in Hawaii while she worked at a hospital there. And listen now as he explains why he would end up needing her more than he could ever imagine.
During the Korean War, we were were coming from Europe with troops, Belgique, Turkish, Norwegian, just the UN.
It was a UN effort. So yeah. You had troops from many different countries, and you're bringing them from Europe to Korea.
To Korea. Got orders to go to Guam to pick up, call it a half track, with four old-fashioned machine guns on it. What they needed them for, the Chinese, they would make 500-man charges in the middle of the night, all firing automatic weapons.
So you guys went to Guam to pick up these armored vehicles that would have the machine guns to go against them.
To stop those 500-man charges. So we pulled into Incheon Harbor, and they were loaded on the deck of a troop ship, all tied down. They did that all at the shipyard on Guam. When we got there, they left everybody on sea watches, but the deck sea watch had to help with the unloading crew. And I had four guys in my crew. The crane that they had sent was what they called a dog leg crane. It hung like that in the air, and it wasn't tall enough to handle the pick when they made it. And the pick would just go crazy banging on things here and there. And they devised a system of, took the cargo cables on the ship and tied two of them on the opposite sides of the load to kind of keep it from flying around. And it worked. But my crew got this assigned to doubling the hawser that was holding the cargo barge in place. It was on the opposite side of the crane. Our ship, dogleg crane, and the barge, the wind came up, and that barge was threatening to break loose. So we went and doubled that hawser that was holding it. We got it done. And we were standing, I was standing on the bollard, a big cast iron thing that to put ropes around to tie the ship to. I was standing up on top of it to see what I had been doing. And somebody screamed, "Look out, look out." And I looked out and turned. And one of those machines was coming at me 100 miles an hour. And it was about an arm's length away. So I, just right from the position I was in, I just threw myself over the side of the ship. I was afraid to try to drop down because I didn't know whether that thing was going to land, or it looked like it could.
So this half track is going to crash into you or crush you if you don't do something.
If I don't do something. So I jumped over the side. And as soon as I did it, I remembered the lecture from my survival training bosun mate at Sheepshead Bay. He said, "One thing you never ever do is jump off your ship. Never. Never jump off." And I just did it. And of course, I had no idea where I was going to land. I knew if I landed on that steel deck of that crane, it was all over. So I had accepted death without any problem. But I didn't land on the deck. I landed in the water and immediately went 30 feet deep, probably. I could see our ship. The hull was painted red. I could see the crane. It had furry stuff all over the bottom, seaweed stuff. And the barge, it was clean. They were like toys up there. I knew, again from survival training, that the air in my clothes would bring me up once, but only once. When I finally stopped going down, and because I fell from so far, almost 40 feet, it blew the air out of my lungs and my skin on my backside and side of my head. It was all black and blue. Instantly, and I had somehow bit my cheek inside, and it was bleeding like hell. And how do you spit blood out without letting water in?
Right.
You figure it out real quick, and it worked.
You fall from 40 feet. You don't even know yet how severe your injuries are going to be, but you've got to make it back to the surface or you're a goner.
Well, you know you're going to come up once. You've been told that. The air in your clothes will bring you up once. And when I came up, I was looking at a scene that became a PTSD thing. My friend, who was standing in front of me, and the damn thing clipped his legs off, you know, between the gunwale of the ship and the tracks of the machine. And just instantly I knew that his legs were cut off because he was lying on his back without any problem. And this is another thing you learn in survival training. Your legs are what pulls you under. They have no air in them. The rest of your body, even in your head, there's air. When I saw him laying like that without any problem trying to stay on, I knew his legs were gone. And there was a big purple cloud forming around him. But I'm spellbound by this scene, and he was trying to talk to me. He was looking at me with his eyes open, trying to talk to me, but he was making little sounds like a small animal might make. So I'm spellbound by this thing, scene I'm looking at, and I'm hearing the sounds he's making, not words. They were just not words. They were just little chirps and squeaks. And
so all his body had the strength to get out.
Yeah. So the guys on the barge were throwing life jackets on the water, and instead of going and getting one, I'm spellbound by the scene I'm looking at and hearing, and eventually it was too late. I went to try to get to it. I missed the last one. The first one that I came to, I just missed it and went under. And there's no coming back the second time. But when I got down about almost to where daylight stops, it's about 30 feet is when you begin to lose daylight. It depends on the water. But I got to a point where I seemed like I had stopped, and I looked up, and there was a beautiful aluminum-painted hook coming down. The guys on the crane, you know, you can't throw a rope on the water. It'll float. It won't go in. But they put a steel cable with a hook on it over the side, and it was coming down. So I waited for it to get there, and I grabbed it and yanked on it to let them know they had a hook, and they yanked me up out of there.
So if they hadn't seized that moment and reacted on the spot with that ingenuity, you've got two kids that never would have been born, grandkids, and a beautiful red-headed great-granddaughter here who wouldn't be here.
That's true.
Wow.
Yeah, it's all true. But you can't dwell on it or think too much about it.
But you had no choice for a while because your injuries were pretty significant.
Yeah, I had no idea what was wrong, but my legs weren't working. Turned out I had major injuries in my spine just from the fall. A lot of hurt from the fall, black and blue, and I was really badly bruised. It's like falling on, not concrete, but like falling on grass when you fall in the water.
So that must have been a very delicate situation to try to get you the medical care you needed.
Well, they didn't know what to do with me. The ship's doctor came around every day. I was already in sick bay. I kind of went into shock, I think, or something. And the next day I was told that my friend had died and that I had, they called it internal injury. The fact that my legs wouldn't work was a big concern.
Yeah, you don't know if they're ever going to work again.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. That occurred to me over many hours. And nobody knew enough to lie to me. Everything's going to be okay. Nobody did because they were scared to death.
They just let you marinate in that fear and uncertainty.
Yeah.
How long were you in the hospital?
Well, it took 40 days to get back to New York. The ship's doctor wanted to put me ashore in the Philippines. But the skipper and I knew about Clark Field. We had put a guy ashore there a couple of years before, and they had cut his leg off. It was Civil War medicine. So the skipper wouldn't let the doctor put me ashore there. He said we'd got to take him back to New York. That's where his best bet is. By the time I got there, I had lost about 40 pounds, and this leg had atrophied to the point, I guess something was cut off or something, and it just was like an arm.
Your left leg was shriveled up to that degree.
Yeah.
And did you have any control of your legs by now?
No.
So you get to New York, you still can't move your legs.
I was in traction. It was a spring. The carpenter fixed it up. He put door springs on it.
People are starting to understand why I referred to you as a walking miracle. So you finally get to Staten Island, and then what?
Well, on the way ashore, I pleaded with the first mate to call Muriel and her mother. They called to let them know that I would be at the hospital. But a strange thing happened there, all part of this miracle thing. The guy driving the ambulance is an old guy. He rolled my gurney onto the deck, went through a door, and there was a well-lit corridor there. And he rang the bell, and then he came over to me and said, "Welcome home, young man." And I cried.
I have to imagine that the uncertainty of your future had to feel overwhelming.
Yeah, and Muriel.
You don't know if she's going to come, she's going to see you, she's going to still want to be with you?
When she came, did you read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Uh-huh.
We had a Nurse Cratchit. And Nurse Cratchit, when Muriel and her mom came and went, she came and planted herself at my door and announced to everybody on the third floor, "Would you believe that pretty Jersey girl is going to marry that basket case in 301? And I wanted to go kill her, but I was strapped in bed. I was hoping somebody else would, but nobody did. I eventually began to see it as funny.
And I know, Chuck, that this has been your life, and this is a story you've written about in your book, and you've told it a time or two. But when you think about that sailor in that hospital bed with this destroyed spinal area, and that girl who loves you enough to say, I don't know what your future is going to look like, but I'm going to be part of it. How incredible is that?
It was incredible, and it's exactly what happened. And it didn't happen until I was being discharged with this crazy brace on.
Yeah, tell me about that brace.
Well, it was steel with leather, and it went around my hips, and there was a, I called it a beam in the back, rod. There was a little mattress on my front, and the mattress was laced with big heavy shoestring to the beam that was in the back so that I couldn't move an inch. I mean, my body was, my legs moved, and, well, this one had a problem, but...
The left one was still weak from the atrophy?
Yeah.
But they were moving again?
But they wouldn't, they didn't function. I couldn't stand on them or anything.
So that's the shape that you get discharged in?
Yeah, I was being discharged with this goofy brace on, and my legs were working to the point where I could walk behind a chair and push it. But I didn't know until the moment, practically, that I was going out the door that I said I had to wear this brace. And I went back in and asked the doctor. He said, we don't have the skill here to get you out of it. It's saving your life. And Muriel understood it when he explained it. He explained it to her. I said to her, Muriel, you didn't fall in love with a guy that is in a monster brace like this. You go home and tell your mom that it's all over and it's okay. She said, Chuck, you got to get used to the idea. You're stuck with me. It was incredible.
Kind of sounds like a line from a movie, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And maybe they ought to make a movie. You've written the book.
She said it.
You were wearing that stylish brace for your wedding?
Yeah. It didn't show under my suit coat. We went on our honeymoon, came back to Jersey and packed up and went to California. And when we got here, I was having trouble with this left leg. So Muriel looked up in phone book where the Naval Hospital was. So it was in North Long Beach. We went in there and the doctor, he did what he could for my problem. And Muriel said, what's with this brace? Why can't you people take it off? And he said, we don't have the skill to do it. It's saving his life. And that's kind of the way it was. But she never let him off the hook. She just kept after him. When she bugged him about it, he said, we don't have anyone with the skill, but there is a little old guy over here. He says, I think he's retired, but he's still working. His name is Mosher B. Taylor. She had his name and address written down by then, and we were there 3 days later. And Mosher B. Taylor, a tiny little Jewish man, that said to Muriel, young lady, you have to be scared to death of the future, but I'm so happy to tell you that I can fix him. Me and two pigs. He says, the pigs won't know about it, but they'll be there. I guess I was 2 or 3 months in White Memorial Hospital in East Los Angeles. And when I came out of there, I was carrying that brace under my arm. Somehow he was able, or knew how, to shave that pig bone to a point where it could readily weld itself to my bones. I guess pigs and people have very similar bones, but to just physically do it was scaring those other doctors away.
So using pig bones, he added them to your existing spinal structure to give you the stability that you could walk and do everything else that you wanted to do without that brace.
Yeah.
How crazy does that sound, Chuck?
Yeah, miracle crazy.
Uh-huh. But it worked.
Yeah, it worked. When I walked out of there, I was carrying the brace.
You must have felt like $1 million.
Yeah, sure did.
And none of it would have happened without that good-looking nurse right here in this photo on your nightstand.
That's the truth. And I got another story regarding her and her mother. I talked about this picture I was looking at when I, instead of getting my life jacket,
turned that traumatic scene of your friend with his legs cut off in the water.
And talking to me.
Right.
When our baby was Kathleen, she was born, Muriel had her in a little bassinet close to our bed. I would wake up in the middle of the night, wide awake and hearing the sound that I had heard.
Of your friend trying to form words and talk to you.
Of course, she was making the noises that little babies make. And I got to the point where I decided the thing to do is to get up and very quietly go out in the backyard and talk to the dog, and the dog seemed to want me to talk to him. He would look at me, and it was just amazing. He tried his best to get me to tell him what the problem was. Anyway, Muriel's mom came out to help with the baby. She began to realize that this thing was going on in the night.
But you were having these recurring flashbacks to that traumatic scene.
Well, she didn't have any idea what was going on, but she knew I was going out in the backyard at night.
Uh-huh.
With the dog. She had no training in PTSD. Didn't even have a name.
Right.
But she just knew somehow, she was a nurse, whatever was wrong needed to be talked about. She just kept asking questions. I eventually told her that there's a scene that I see at night that I couldn't not see. It's just there, and I've got to look at it. Guys that don't shoot themselves,
right. The
guys that don't want to see it again, and that's still happening.
Yes.
They don't have Muriel's mom to help them. But she would keep asking questions and trying to get a handle on it, and eventually I described the scene for her without making a decision to do it. It just happened. Probably 4 days later, I'd stop seeing it.
And never saw it again?
Never saw it again. Well, I can see it in my mind, but...
If you want to.
Yeah.
Boy, Chuck, I can't help but listen to all this and think that you've had some kind of life.
And I had a lot of fun, and I was helped so often, so by so many.
Well, and I'm sure you've provided help to a lot. And just even here in your home in Claremont, you and Muriel, as you shared with me so many years, would rent out rooms to students here at the Claremont group of colleges. And how long were you and Muriel married before you lost her?
She died in the 65th year of our marriage.
Mm-hmm.
65 years.
And you've got her picture from the 1940s right here.
Yep.
How often do you look over at that?
Quite often. Say goodnight to her every night. And the little lady.
Well, how do you make sense of it, Chuck? What do you think was happening there? Why you? Why are you the guy who all these things happened to, and somehow you made it through all of that?
Well, I think I've said it before. You go crazy trying to analyze it. I deal with what you got.
Mm-hmm. And I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us about it. I don't think anyone's ever heard a story quite like this before. But when you think back over almost 95 years now, come September, you're hitting that 95 mark.
Yeah.
What are you most proud of, and what are you most thankful for?
Well, I couldn't have not had those experiences without that guy on the phone, Merchant Marine recruiter, saying, get on a train and come down and see us. It kind of all started right there, after he found out I was a cowboy.
Right.
I'm most proud of this young lady.
That young lady, of course, his late wife, Muriel. If you visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of Chuck holding his favorite photo of that pretty young nurse he met in such unique fashion. You'll also find that link to his book, The Dog Star Had Their Back, which Chuck hopes might help others facing PTSD. Chuck also had more to say that we couldn't quite fit into our radio time, so you'll find that in the podcast version of this episode online. We're out of time for now, but thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. I promised there was more, and I mentioned that Chuck had some fortunate breaks in his pursuit of Muriel, so let's hear about that. Even though she eventually found out the bad news that you couldn't take her on your ship to Hawaii, she stayed in touch with you?
Well, she couldn't get away. We were on the same train. And we ended up, her girlfriend, Mary Jane Craig, who was just like her, pretty and well-trained, and she had fallen in love already with a kid from Nebraska who was on the train with them. He was an ex-sailor, but he was out of the service, and he was actually going to the University of Montana. And he got off of the train in Utah, in Salt Lake City, to go up there. So then I had these two beautiful girls on my hands. Well, when we got to Los Angeles, and that poor little old train just chugged along and kept doing what it had to do and finally got us there. And if you can believe it, their luggage was intact.
After all of that?
After all of that. It had been done by cowboys in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
They went into that frozen train and got them and put them on the,
wow,
the train. It was amazing.
So you get to L.A., and what next?
Get to L.A., and I'm running with the crowd to get into the tunnel that goes under and over. And I thought, what the hell am I hurrying for? I'm 2 weeks late, or a week and a half late, and I owe it to those girls to check on them. So I stopped, and I turned around, and they were at a payphone, not doing anything. So I went back, and I said, ask them what's going on. They said, well, we thought maybe the man that was supposed to meet us before would be here. Well, that poor bastard, this is 10 days ago or something. He was probably in Las Vegas by then. I wanted to tell you about my getting to Hawaii. I was on my ship on the flying bridge doing my job as a chief wheelman. And I looked down. Well, I was airing the flags. And you can sometimes by accident put up a nasty word just by accident. So I had a pair of glasses on around my neck to look at people that may be saying nasty things on the blinkers.
The Morse code that's going back from ship to ship?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Kind of keeping track of things. When I realized that there was no problem, I relaxed, and I looked down at another ship, a beautiful little freighter, and a guy walked on the main deck, climbed the ladder, and got up on the upper deck, and damned if I didn't know him. I had sailed with him out in the Aleutians years before, and I hollered down, and he couldn't hear me, so I got a light and aimed at him and said nasty words, and he turned around and said, who the hell are you? I told him who I was, and I said, what are you doing in California? And he says, believe it or not, this little beauty is mine. I'm going to Hawaii. Believe it or not, I ended up going to Hawaii with him.
You got off of that ship and onto his?
He arranged the whole thing.
Huh.
You know, the transfers are four sheets of paper and four sheets of carbon. Those poor wacks that have to do it, they're doing like this on an old mechanical typewriter.
Yeah.
But they managed it. So I ended up on his ship. I had to take a cut in pay, but that was...
Where were you supposed to go?
My ship, the big ship, was going to Japan and then back to Europe.
But because you happen to spot him and communicate with him through Morse code and find out he's going to Hawaii, you say, I got to go to Hawaii to find that girl.
Yep.
How about that?
Incredible.
And somehow you convinced her that she should marry you?
Well, it took a couple of years. They had flown to Hawaii. I think I told you that her dad arranged for air flight. They flew on what they called a China Clipper.
Right.
It was a giant propeller-driven plane that took 9 hours to fly over there.
So they've been there for a while by the time you get there.
Yeah, and they had probably completely forgotten about me. But when I got there, I knew where their hospital was. I was familiar with Hawaii, with Honolulu. So I went to the hospital and asked for her. Person there said, she's on the 3 to 11. You'll see her then. So I went out and came back. I had always rented an old Ford convertible, and I was in it. When I came back, I knew if her shift was 3 to 11, she'd be getting off at 11, and that's when I wanted to be there. So I was there. And I got out of the car, went to the front steps of the hospital, sat on the steps. Of course, the shift changed, and all these pretty girls come out. And just about the last one was Muriel. And Mary Jane wasn't even out yet. The other one was still, because they took their jobs very seriously, and they didn't run out. She spotted me, and she says, good Lord, what are you doing here? And I said, I forgot some laundry at the shop on Hotel Street, and I came back to get it. She says, don't tell me that. She said, well, I guess we're glad to see you. And I was there on that little ship all summer. The guys got a real break, you know. He was still in that Aleutian Island trade, and somehow they got this order to go to Central Pacific for the summer. I don't know how he arranged it, but it was wonderful for the whole crew, including the old guy they took along with them. So that's another more than coincidence.
Well, it's got to be, right?
It's just incredible.
How do you explain it?
I can't, and I don't try. It's like those other things I'm telling you. If you try to explain it all, you go crazy. I just accept it.
And you wrote a lot of these stories you shared with us here on the radio, you've written down in that book. Is there something you hope people get out of reading that book, something they'll take away from your story?
Well, the PTSD thing is so poorly dealt with. I'd like to think that me telling that, people will believe it, and are hoping that they will believe it, accidentally helping somebody save his life.
And that's really what it is when it comes to PTSD and the suicide epidemic among our veterans. So you're saying you're hoping your story provides hope for people who maybe don't feel a whole lot.
Well, they don't know how simple it is to get rid of it. It's not simple, but it takes very specific things to happen.
Because the last thing you want to do when you're in the throes of that is talk about it.
It doesn't occur to you. I was aware of the fact that the dog wanted me to tell him. The way he looked at me, he says, tell me about it. Mm-hmm. And Muriel's mom said the same things, and it worked.
Well, there's a thought that occurs to me, so I'm going to ask you about it. And I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head or words in your mouth or get you to go where my brain might go. But you knew you had to talk to the dog about it. What about turning that word dog around to God? Do you see an impact of God in your story? Is that part of your understanding or no?
Well, he's always been there. Like my affiliation with the Dog Star, all of my Irish grandmothers, mother and grandmothers, they saw that Dog Star as I'm not sure what the right word is to say, but the Dog Star for them and for me, I guess, he's a connecting link to God. God scares the hell out of most people. He's really quite a nice guy, but you'd never know it hearing these people scream about him.
And we can't see God But no. You can see the dog star, and that reminds you of God? Is that what I hear you saying?
I guess that's it. He's there and just as consistent as is God. We can go out there tonight and look at him. I can't see him anymore, but he's there.
Chuck's eyesight is failing. He can't see things the way he used to. But his perspective after almost 95 years is crystal clear, and he's helped the rest of us see his story in vivid color. Don't forget to check out his book, The Dog Star Had Their Back.